This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Richard and I have been covering on a surprisingly newsy Monday morning. That includes some OPEC Plus members, including Saudi and the UAE, extending voluntary oil cuts. We're going to hear from the OPEC Plus watcher, Amina Bakker, and Ed Bell, who is a commodities expert, as well as an economist at Emirates NBD. One of the other big stories of the morning was Emirates selling naming rights to a number of its petrol stations. Ali bin Zayed Al Falassi is a senior manager for corporate loyalty at Emirates. He's been telling us why they're doing it. Dubai taxi company recently came out with its first ever full year earnings as a publicly listed company, a 54% rise in net profit, an 11% rise in revenue, and an 8% rise in the number of journeys that we're all taking around the place. Mansour Rahma Al Falassi is their CEO. He's spoken to us this morning, while Richard, on CEO Watch, has been speaking to Tarek Al-Saka, who's the CEO of Dubai Refreshments. A 9% rise in Pepsi case sales locally. What does that tell us about what we're all up to?
Brandy, when we came in this morning for our morning meeting before the show, so just before 6 o'clock this morning, and every day we review the news days, and sometimes it's a heavy news day and sometimes it's a light news day and all points in between. Brandy, how did you describe the news agenda today when you came in this morning?
Oh, I said I was excited about it.
But you had a, what was it? Big news, lots, day good.
the words were not in order. We did literally sit down and I said, yes, big news, lots words, good. And Rich was like, that's not how we're going to put it on air, is it?
But I got your point. There's just a lot happening at the moment. Should we start with the OPEC Plus deal, which around about 6-7 o'clock last night, it began to break that those production cuts were being extended until June. What do we know?
Yeah, indeed. And this is a story that has evolved, starting with Bloomberg, who'd spoken to a couple of delegates who didn't want to be named, who were just calling them OPEC Plus cuts. Sort of in general, we've had more detail added on to that. Saudi Arabia's state news agency has now published it, which is about as good as you get, isn't it? And these are, as Amina Bakker pointed out earlier, the voluntary cuts coming from members including Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Russia. So it's not an OPEC announcement as such. We've got the next big OPEC meeting because they've gone back to their usual schedule. In COVID, we quite got used to an OPEC meeting every 5 minutes on Zoom. That's not the case anymore. But, so we'll wait and see what they're going to do in June, and we'll hear Amina on that a little bit later. But let's have a look at where we are at the moment and why they might be extending those voluntary 2 million barrel cuts. Amina is a senior research analyst at the Energy Intelligence Group. She's also an OPEC watcher. She goes and covers the meetings. She gets squished in the stairwell with everyone else where they're waiting for the meeting to finish. And we said to her, if we look at the band that we're in, and Matt Stanley was speaking to us about it on Friday, the fact that there's been this sort of quite a narrow $10 band, despite the fact that we've had so much geopolitical uncertainty and all the Red Sea disruptions. So we said to Amina, how has oil managed to stay so steady, given everything that's going on?
It's become kind of very insensitive to any of the geopolitical tension that's happened in the region here. But we have to remember one thing is that these attacks by the groups in the Red Sea haven't really led to any kind of significant supply crunch. So if you look at the fundamentals, they're very much balanced. Is the risk there? Yes. Is the market underestimating the geopolitical risk or the possibility of a bigger disruption? I would say yes as well. But that hasn't translated into the price. And I think for the time being, even if you have higher freight rates and higher insurance rates, and you have vessels that are not taking the path of the Strait of Hormuz / the Red Sea, that hasn't translated yet into higher prices that the consumers feel.
Well, of course, the other part of the price equation is demand and supply. We asked Amina this morning, what is the biggest risk to OPEC's demand outlook? And why isn't it necessarily getting the $90 that we know Fitch Ratings says that Saudi needs at the moment for the books? Is it increased American supply? Is it reduced Chinese demand? This is Amina.
they're definitely putting all their hopes on higher demand. If this higher demand doesn't materialize, it means that they need to keep the cuts in place for longer. And I think that the challenge for the group really is to how they're going to be unwinding these various layers of cuts, because you have a voluntary cut that's by some members, and then you have a group cut that's the 2 million, and then you have an additional 1.6 voluntary cut by some members. So this multi-layered cut approach that they've taken needs to be unwound, and there's one factor really at the basis of this, and it's demand. Demand needs to pick up.
So what does it all mean for the UAE? We've been investing in increased production, and yet we are expanding our voluntary cuts.
The UAE hasn't halted or pressed pause on its production capacity. They're at around 4.6 million barrels a day of production capacity. They're hoping to reach 5 million by 2027. But the spending has been factored in already for the UAE. So I don't I imagine that companies like ADNOC would like to start producing more. They don't want to sit on a lot of spare capacity. Sitting on spare capacity is an expensive exercise. But at the same time, I'm noticing that there is a high degree of OPEC unity, collaboration within the group. I'm not seeing anyone break ranks.
And that is Amina Bakker. She's an OPEC watcher. She's also a senior analyst at the Energy International Group.
Yeah, I was looking at the production cuts from the UAE because WAM, the news agency, gave a bit of detail on it overnight. We're up to now just over 300,000 barrels a day of production cuts, and they're broken into two bits. I know you were looking at what's a voluntary production cut and what's a this production cut. It's 300,000-ish barrels a day. If we're at, say, $100 a barrel, we're not quite there. But to make the math simple, that is $30 million a day that we're giving up because of those production cuts. So since we've been on air, 3 hours, you know, do the math. It's not cheap. But of course, if it supports prices, that's clearly what the UAE is looking at, bigger picture.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
And a big story for us this morning, and so many comments coming in. So thank you very, very much for that. And that is Emirat selling the naming rights for service stations in Dubai and the Northern Emirates. Extremely pleased to be joined this morning by Ali bin Zayed Al Falazi, who is a senior manager for corporate loyalty at Emirat. Ali, it's lovely to see you. Good morning.
Likewise. Thank you very much for having me here.
So why is Emirat doing this?
So just to give the audience a brief about Emirat or the background. So Emirat was inaugurated in 1980 as the first national fuel retailer in the region. So Emirat not only has a few retail stations, but we have extensive background in B2B business. We do have a commercial part for a B2B part. So we do have LPG, we do have commercial fuels, natural gas, actually one of the biggest network in the Northern Emirates when it comes to natural gas supply. So now back to our topic. We're very excited to have inaugurated Project Landmark. So what we wanted to give is we wanted to tap into the innovative approach of things. We wanted to reimagine the fuel retailer's future. Thus, we launched the naming rights project, Project Landmark. And we do say it's not just naming rights, it's much more. So why we did that? From that perspective, we wanted to reimagine the future of fuel stations. And what can we do to enhance the customer experience for our customers? So from that perspective, we launched Project Landmark.
How will it enhance the customer experience?
So from that perspective, if you imagine, so let's go back from the business part. So yeah, let's go back from to the business part. So we're looking at it from two perspectives. How do we benefit the partner that joins us, and how do we benefit the customer? So from the partner's perspective, We give them extensive branding opportunities, touch points, ways, different ways of enhancing their brand approach with Emirat. Emirat has millions of customers that go to their fuel stations on a yearly basis and thousands on a daily basis. So that itself has a huge exposure for the business. Now, for the customer part, each partner that will join the naming rights project will have different ways of showcasing their products and services in the fuel station. So basically, it's going to be their landscape or their canvas to display their products. So the customers will have specific activations. They will have different products exclusively for them on that station, and there will be a large variety of partners that will add bigger value, not only from the fuel part, but they will have these partners to have different offerings for them.
Does that mean that if you ended up with a bank partner, you could change whose ATMs are in there, for example?
Definitely. So not only that, but then the bank partner will have a specific offer for these thousands of people. So imagine, I'm happy to announce that we signed with the first partner of the naming rights, Almeria Bank, that will take the first piece of the naming rights station. We have shortlisted the best 31 stations in Emirat Petroleum from a network perspective that has the highest footfall, has a different community as part of it, and will add that value. So from a banking perspective or other than that, we do have a list of variety of different business landscapes that will join us in the naming rights. So they will have ATMs, they will have different activations. And the unique part of all of that, there is two aspects. There's the physical branding aspect, which includes the branding rights. So imagine you're driving through an Emirat station and you say Emirat and business breakfast station. So imagine having that business breakfast station. You can use that canvas to display whatever you offer from different products and services. So it kind of varies from the business background. So you can have, for example, your own station that you can interview people in it. So from the banking perspective, any launch of a credit card, you will tap into the thousands of people. You'll tap into the staff that can upsell your products. You'll tap into the retail partners that we have. So there is a huge business benefit from that perspective. And from a digital one, sorry to cut you off. From a digital one, we do have an award-winning loyalty program that we have launched last year. So imagine having more than 500,000 people digitally at your disposal, upselling your product and knowing more about it. So there is different channels. Thus, we call that a partnership at Emirat.
How much are the naming rights going for?
It depends. So just like having, I cannot disclose numbers because it varies from different locations. So we do have stations on Sheikh Zayed Road. We have stations closer to industrial areas. We have, so it all depends on the landscape. It all depends on the footfall. It all depends on the nature of the customers and what is the partner might require.
But what kind of ballpark are we talking for this? Are we talking hundreds of thousands? Are we talking millions?
We're talking millions.
Of dirhams?
Of dirhams.
You've shortlisted those 31 stations. How much interest have you got already and from what kind of companies?
We had actually a lot of interest from different companies. So we have from a big retailers in the market, actually big names already showed interest that have, and we have from a different group of family businesses that already reached out to us since the inauguration. So we're looking at around 20 to 30 companies that already showed interest. We are closing with a second partner, which I cannot disclose yet. But things actually have been moving quite fast because the offering we have for our project landmark is quite different. It's not the traditional naming rights. We wanted to offer more than that. As I mentioned, you can tap into all our customers, and it's a win-win from the business part and also from the customer part.
It also generates quite a nice amount of money for Emirat. One of your competitors, ADNOC Distribution, is now a listed company. With my business breakfast hat on, I'd look at this and wonder if that was one of the reasons that you were doing this. Is there any talk about taking Emirat public?
Of course, everyone has that perspective. Everyone wants to go public. We are studying multiple options, but there's nothing solid yet in that perspective. We, for the time being, we focus on customer centricity, enhancing our customer experience, how from our perspective, we can give our customers the best value. Like as you know, fuel is fuel, non-fuel is non-fuel. And then how can I make you come to Emirat, or what kind of offerings I can give you? So we do have a loyalty program, actually one of the most generous loyalty programs that we have launched in terms of value. And now we are giving different opportunities with the Project Landmark. So imagine going to Emirat and having not just fuel and more than that.
20 seconds left with you. How do you get people to actually use the name and not just say the Emirat on Al Wasl?
So before going to that, now we have different criteria of choosing the partners that set with Emirat values. I think there were a couple of questions that asked about different brands. So basically, it's going to be a co-branded approach that will be Emirat co-branded station with a partner. So we can say Emirat Dubai Eye Station. So that will be named digitally. It will be on the facade. It will be on all touch points from a branding perspective. So when you enter, you can actually see it.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Ashamed to wrap up this conversation. But we have rules and ad breaks. Ali bin Zayed Al Falassi is Senior Manager for Corporate Loyalty at Emirates, speaking to us this morning about their decision to sell naming rights for their service stations in Dubai and the Northern Emirates. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
And speaking to another big newsmaker this morning, Dubai Taxi Company announced its full year results right at the end of our final show of last week. But the 54% number for the rise in full year net profit, its first as a newly listed company, made us think, don't care that it's the end of the show on a Friday, we need to get them on. So we are very pleased to be joined this morning by Mansour Rahmah Al Falassi, who's the CEO of Dubai Taxi Company. Mansour, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Good morning, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak today about the results of the financial statements of Dubai Taxi Company in 2023.
Okay, let's start by looking at that rise in revenue. 11% and an 8% rise in trips for your taxis and your limousines. What can you tell me about the growth in demand at the moment?
Of course, Dubai Taxi Company, and each year we work very hard to increase the revenue and more work on the efficiency of our fleets so that we can gain a lot of trips. And this shows how we secured last year 46 million number of trips in total of our fleet. And of course, when it comes to the EBITDA margin and the other margins, we scored a very healthy results, which shows how Dubai Taxi Company is benefiting from the position of its here in Dubai when it comes to the growth of the city, the population, the visitors, the tourists. So all of these attributes help us a lot to achieve such tremendous results in our first year post the listing in Dubai financial market.
You mentioned tourists there. What kind of rise in demand have you seen at Dubai Airport, where you've got the exclusivity?
Of course, we secured this prime location for more than three decades. And of course, if you notice the news from the Dubai International Airport with the rise of about 30% of comers and visitors to Dubai, this gives us the privilege to secure a lot of trips from the Dubai International Airport. And of course, this will benefit the company from the results and the growth in the city, and not only the airport itself, but of course the city, because we notice a lot of demand, especially from the prime location that also we operate in the city, also from the e-hailing platform that we generate a lot of trips from this application, which is Hala, it is well known here in Dubai. And all of these comes from the efficiency of our fleet. The 24/7 operations comes from the our OCC, or the control room. And of course, with the availability of the cars is very important when it comes to such number of trips that need to be acquired on each year. Yeah.
What percentage of your beige taxi rides are now Hala taxi rides?
Well, with Hala, we reach almost like 40% of total trips comes from the platform, from Hala platform. And of course, our colleagues in RTA, they are having a very solid plan for the coming 5 years to reach up to 80% of the total trips generated from the e-hailing platform, because of all of us knows how things changed post the pandemic. People start to focus more on the e-commerce and the applications. So of course the behavior of customers changed a lot since that moment. And of course, we should be ready for such a new trend coming to the city here in Dubai.
Speaking of new trends, the real estate of Dubai is moving ever outwards, more projects being built further out from the centre. Are you seeing the distances of your trips increase? Can you give me any figures that would let us realise how that is impacting the length of our taxi rides?
Well, when it comes to such urban planning, of course, Dubai is moving into new urban plans, and maybe you notice the new expansion of the metro in the city, and this shows how Dubai expanding a lot. And of course, when it comes to our fleet, we are ready to acquire such demand in the city. Thanks for the e-hailing platform. Thanks for our OCC, which looks into such demand. And of course, we are ready to help and to serve our customers who are sitting in such a neighborhood. And we believe that we are ready to take any kind of special even requirements. And this shows how Dubai Taxi Company started to provide such unique service through our application, which is DTC app. Like, for example, we do have the InSafe Hand, which cater for very special customers who are looking for a reliable service for their kids and, of course, something good for the parents as well.
Are the average trips, though, getting longer?
Of course, if you are going to stay in such, locations in Dubai, of course, you are going to generate and to see very long trips. And this, of course, good for us as a taxi operator. And the same thing, so it's good for the customer, because usually in some cities, it's very rare to have such service running, taxi service running on these, let's say, boundaries of the city. But of course, again, thanks God for having the e-hailing platform, which provides such good service for those customers who are sitting on these locations and to help them to move from point to point here in the city of Dubai.
Reading your earnings, you've mentioned that there are several opportunities to expand into neighbouring Emirates. Where? Which Emirates?
Well, we are at the moment, we do operate in other verticals like school buses. We do operate in Ajman and Abu Dhabi and Al Ain, and also in Ras Al Khaimah. We do have some school buses over there. And when it comes to the other verticals like the taxi, the limousine, the also delivery bikes, we're exploring opportunities, and of course, we are going to disclose it when it is there and when it is ready. But at the moment, I cannot disclose any kind of information because we are still working very hard to expand and to look into such opportunities which will benefit Dubai Taxi Company as a company, also our shareholders of the company as well.
Okay, we've only just got 1 minute left with you. The delivery bikes is a relatively new area of business for you, but it grew 9x last year. How big could that get for you? How many bikes could you have?
Well, at the moment, we have almost like 1,000 bikes. And of course, this happened in just 1 year. And we believe that this is a very promising vertical because, as I said earlier, things has changed dramatically post the COVID and post the pandemic, when people start to look into the services from any kind of platform. And of course, delivery bikes is running a very successful story here in Dubai. And this is why we have a good relationship with the main aggregator in Dubai, like, for example, Kareem, Smiles, Noon as well. And of course, we are growing in this vertical, and we might reach good numbers in terms of bikes and also in terms of the size of the fleet itself. And this will be announced very soon once we are securing those contracts with the biggest aggregator here in Dubai and maybe beyond Dubai as well.
Thank you so much, Mansour Al-Falassi, the CEO of Dubai Taxi Company.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Yeah, Tariq Al-Sakka, CEO of Dubai Refreshments, the Pepsi bottler. We spoke with him last week after they sold their iconic landmark plot in Al-Khos, just opposite Safa Park, for just over 250 million dirhams. Alpha Tame has bought it. So we began with a bit of a history lesson about Dubai refreshments, and that, it turns out, was not at the first bottling station here in Dubai.
Believe it or not, many people don't remember that, but the old timers will remember that we started on Sheikh Maktoum Street. The first factory was a small factory on Sheikh Maktoum Street in Deira. I don't know, it was Sheikh Maktoum, probably because it's one of the few paved roads in Dubai at the time. However, in the early, by the early 70s, also things had grown and we needed a new facility. And that's when we moved to the iconic site on Sheikh Zayed Road by Safa Park, across from Safa Park. And at the time when we moved there, it was middle of the desert, basically. But there was a vision at the time that this was going to be the hub of Dubai or the center part of Dubai. And it was, we built that site and we stayed there for a very long time. Most of the business was built out of that site until 2016. And then 2016, we moved to our new facility in Dubai Investment Park. We needed a much bigger facility. We have a much more modern, much larger facility now in Dubai Investment Park.
What do you know about what's going to be there? And what about that emotional tie that you have to it? How do your shareholders, how do you feel about something new coming up there?
Well, the emotional, yeah. It took us many years to get to that decision because there was a lot of emotions that we shouldn't sell. We should maybe develop it. We should do something with it. We should keep it. But in the final end, you know, we're a beverage company, and that's not a good location anymore to have a beverage manufacturing facility. That is a location now. I'm not really sure what the new buyer, new owner will do with it, but most likely it's going to be showrooms of some sort, you know, some kind of real estate development that that capitalizes on the value of that land beyond the manufacturing and distribution center that it was when we owned it. It wasn't easy, I can tell you. There was lots of different views among the board and among the management on what should be done. But eventually, the board come to the conclusion that we are a beverage company. People invest in our company and hold our shares because of our beverage, not because we're real estate developers or because we run showrooms or anything like that. And the right thing to do would be to unlock that value for the shareholders and focus our investments in plots of land and where we can do our operations properly. And that's what we did. We sold that and we bought in Sharjah. We developed Sharjah. That's a very ideal location for an operation like ours. Also the DIP move, also if you come to the facility in DIP, you will see it's a huge facility, very modern facility. It's 7 times the size of the Sheikh Zayed Road. So that's what was needed for the future, and that's what we did.
Well, let's
emotions, but eventually, you know, you have to go with the business sense.
Of course, yeah, you're the chief executive of a listed company. So a quarter of a billion dirham windfall that we saw in your profits, your audited accounts.
So the new facility cost us 700 million to put together, between the construction, the equipment, the machinery, the moving. So the IT systems and all the modern stuff that we included in there. So it cost us close to 700 million. So obviously part of it, you know, we've already paid that off to a certain extent. We took a loan, we paid it off. The company's been it's been profitable, it's been generating cash. So we don't really have any debt on our balance sheet that we have to pay off as a result of that sale. So the money, what the board has taken is to invest some of that money in new capexes that like the Sharjah project. There is other projects also on the table, and the balance is going to be paid out to the shareholder. It was value that is available, but the sale of the land allowed us to unlock that value for the shareholder.
Well, let's talk about the underlying business, the beverage business. Pepsi, of course, is your flagship brand. And for those who aren't watching on TV, you're joining me now from your office. You've got a big, a giant Pepsi bottle top behind you. I know you've got some Pepsi artwork in your office. But you have said, I read an interview with you a couple of years ago saying this is a mature business. You've got the license for Pepsi in Dubai and the Northern Emirates, but you don't have it elsewhere. And even if you did, exporting beverages is a tricky thing to do because they're a relatively heavy and low value item. So where does that growth come from? Because I both know you, I know both you and the chairman have talked about growth.
Okay, so there is various things. I mean, if you look at the history for the last 10 years, yes, you can say this is a mature business. Particularly, there is regulation, there is taxes, and so forth. That has impacted COVID. All of this has impacted that business over the last 10 years or so. So we haven't really grown over that period. But if you look at the last 3-4 years, the growth is coming from the bounce back, basically, from all of these headwinds that faced us. So the bounce back and the recovery of the UAE and Dubai in particular after COVID, the economic boom that is happening in this country and the influx of people, that is driving a lot of the consumption of our beverage and other beverages as well. So that has been part of it. The other part of it is we have also been investing in new beverages and we have been investing in new businesses. So if you look at our portfolio, I know we are known for Pepsi, but if you look at it in a little bit more scrutiny, you will find that we have introduced a range of new products like Gatorade, for instance. We have also the Lipton franchise, the Lipton iced tea franchise. That has been growing quite rapidly. We have invested in low-calorie and no-sugar variants. That has also been driving faster growth than the traditional business. We have invested in water. We have the brand Aquafina, and we have we were the first ones, or maybe potentially also still the only ones, who produce Aquafina in cans. That was sold in Expo. If you went to Expo, you could only see Aquafina in cans. We've now expanded that into bottles as well, glass bottles. That's part of our sustainability initiatives, providing people with more options than just the traditional plastic bottles. So we have that piece. Believe it or not, historically, also about 10-11% of our business has been exports. And we do exports to neighboring countries in a variety of ways. There are countries that don't have bottling operations, and there are traders that come by from Dubai and sell in these countries, mostly in Africa, right? So African countries, we even sell to Maldives, for instance. That's one of our, we sell in a lot of places that are either don't have an operation or have a small operation. That is possible also. And then they take from us the products or the SKUs that they don't produce themselves. In Oman, it's an interesting business because we buy Gatorade from them and they buy Lipton iced tea from us. And we are exporting to more than 30 countries. This venture for us has been an agreement that we did with PepsiCo also on the snack side of the business. As you probably know, PepsiCo is a food and beverage company. And the food side is actually bigger globally than the beverage side. That business we were not involved in. Today, we have an agreement with them to support PepsiCo's business in the UAE by storing, delivering, doing some of the logistical work, doing services for them on that business. We're hoping that that business will continue to grow. Last but not least, we've also signed agreements with other companies like Britvic. So we are trying to find new avenues for growth. The base business is growing, but to accelerate that growth further, we are introducing new products and entering into new businesses as well.
My colleague Brandy Scott loves looking at companies like yours as proxy data for what's happening to the population. What are your kind of underlying like-for-like sales of your main beverages in Dubai and Northern Emirates for 2023? And what are you seeing in 2024 so far?
So 2023, our local business was up by about, in terms of case sales, we were up by about 9%. So this is driven, a lot of it has come from the travel, entertainment, tourism sector. These were the fastest growing sort of parts of the business, if you will. The base business, the traditional trade, the modern trade, were also growing quite healthy. But the really fast growth was coming from these areas. We expect it to continue in 2024, and the first month was also quite good, and the second month would continue to grow. I think it will taper off slightly. We may not be able to get the 9% that we did this year, but in my view, we will still be able to grow in the middle kind of single digits numbers. These are good good numbers for a beverage category that is largely mature with very high market share for us. So it's not a question that we're able to gain so much market share because, you know, we already have relatively high market share and the competition is fierce, not just from our red cousins there, but the number of new products coming into the market.
You've talked about tax briefly there, and I know you've spoken before about the excise that was introduced in the UAE a few years ago now, and you said it did have an impact on your business, and you were saying looking at the rate of tax, 50% for many beverages, quite high by international standards. Just explain the economic dynamics of that to us.
So the tax came in late 2016. This is a trend now, global trend, that countries, many countries around the world are introducing taxes on sugary drinks. It's supposed to be a sugar tax. The tax in this part of the world is a little bit different than the way it's administered is different than many of the other countries like the UK. Like if we take the UK as an example, for instance, they tax based on sugar content. So you have 1 liter of beverage, depending on how much sugar is in that 1 liter, you are taxed on that sugar content. In the GCC, the tax is on the value of the product. So if you're selling for 1 dirham, then the tax would be 50 fils. If you're selling for 2 dirhams, then the tax would be 1 dirham and so forth. So it is based on the retail value of the product. There has been a lot of discussions with the industry and, you know, and the different GCC countries about needing to fine tune that system to bring it more in line with the rest of the world. Because in order, really, in our view, it protects the local industry. Because what is happening now is you are starting to get imports that are pricing themselves very cheap, and they're doing that by through a tax subsidy, basically. They say my price is 1 dirham, and they pay 50 fils, versus a local manufacturer's price may be 1.5 dirham, so they have to pay 75 fils. So part of the discount that they are given is actually a tax subsidy to a certain extent.
On the issue of low sugar and relatively healthier drinks and snacks, a lot of talk at Gulf Food this year has been about weight loss drugs, things like Ozempic. They're going to change consumer habits. They're going to change the industry. What's your view?
My view is people don't drink you know, our products for health reasons. They drink them because they enjoy to have a little treat, if you will, like a piece of chocolate or like an ice cream or like anything you take as a treat. So I don't think these kind of products are related to a certain extent to our beverages. People drink our beverages for enjoyment purpose, not for health reasons. If you are going to drink for health reasons, you're going to choose something else. Maybe water, maybe water with a little bit of flavor in it. And we are producing now. If you look at our portfolio now, we have a much, much wider choice for the consumers. We are known for Pepsi. But if you look at our portfolio now, we are trying to address every consumer need. And every consumer that has a choice to make, we have an option for that. And that's what we're trying to do. I don't think, you know, I'm not really sure. I haven't thought about it very deeply, to be honest, but I don't think Ozempic or Mounjaro or any of these should have a big impact on our products. I think the health consciousness is there. It's been a trend, and you're going to see more and more products that are addressing some of these needs for the consumers.
Finally, let me ask you about big events and celebrities. We had the FIFA Football World Cup just around the corner in Qatar not very long ago. Mohamed Salah, the Egyptian footballer, one of your brand ambassadors, one of the big stars in the Arab world, maybe even the big star. We got a little bit further out. We got a Football World Cup happening in Saudi Arabia, we think, in a decade or so's time. In cold, hard marketing terms, these things are expensive to support events or celebrities. Where's the ROI?
Okay, so PepsiCo in general is more into celebrities than events. Okay, so the focus is on big stars like Messi, like Salah, like before that Shaquille O'Neal, and if you remember, Tiger Woods with Gatorade and Michael Jordan. So the history goes back many. So you have to establish that kind. It cannot be just a one-time thing and it disappears. You have to maintain the consistency of that positioning that you're trying to put. Is that great people drink our product. Shaquille O'Neal, when I first joined Pepsi almost 30 years ago, we had Shaquille O'Neal, and he was at the height of his popularity at the time. So there is two platforms that Pepsi uses very effectively, in my view. One is music, and one is sports in general. With a big focus in the Middle East, the focus is on football because that's the mass sport, that's the sport that the majority of the people are attached to. If you go to India, you see a big focus on cricket. Once you do that, then you can establish that connection in the minds of consumers.
Tarek Al-Saka speaking, the CEO of Dubai Refreshments, the local bottler for Pepsi.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.